Thanks very much, and it's a great pleasure to be here for on a second occasion. Although I do have to say, Mr. President, that when you put an economist on the program following someone who claims to be named Adam Smith, this is not exactly subtle. And the other prefatory remark I might make is that while I have done a great deal of work on inequality, and the program says that I would be speaking on that, and I do in fact have a book, which Oxford will be bringing out in a few weeks, called Inequality and Instability, I'm not in fact going to spend much time talking about it today. In fact, I had been reading Adam Smith, the real one, with my with my undergraduates, and I'm prompted by that experience, and particularly by some ways in which Smith's line of thought connects to our modern condition, to try to give you in 30 minutes a sweeping historical argument about where we are, why we are where we are today. And the beginning of that argument, I have to say, in the beginning, there was oil. If I had to identify a single factor, a very dangerous thing to try to do, but a single factor that captures the arc of American prosperity in the last century, I think it would have to be oil. The fact is, we were, in this country, singularly blessed. We discovered the stuff. We had a great deal of it here. It defined how the 20th century unfolded for us. It revolutionized our agriculture. It gave us an entirely new transportation system. It transformed the military balance of the world, giving us both land transport and aviation, which did not exist before. The fact that we had it and that Germany and Japan did not was in many ways decisive in the Second World War. It was FDR's embargo that prompted Pearl Harbor. It was Germany's drive to the Caucasus that got them as far as Stalingrad. And in the post-war period, it was abundant, cheap oil that gave us the structure of American life in the 50 years following the war. It gave us interstate highways, it gave us suburbs, it gave us the car culture. It gave us the capacity to have a great deal of highly profitable resource-using business and households, resource-using households who were accordingly very comfortable, comfortable by standards much higher than we've ever been seen before. Other fuels, coal, natural gas, nuclear, could have contributed, and it did contribute to this to a degree, but they could not have delivered quite the same result. They could not have been configured to the same effect. And then there was a turning point, which came in 1970. And it came because, not because oil ran out or became scarce, but because the production of cheap conventional oil onshore in the lower 48 United States peaked, and the main supplies moved offshore to the Gulf, to the Middle East, to Venezuela, to OPEC generally. And most importantly, we lost control of the price. And everybody who is here of a certain age certainly remembers the effect of that. It was very destabilizing. The problem is not that oil is such a big piece of the economy, but it's a very important piece of profitability. And when resource costs rise, profits were squeezed, inflation resulted, you had a combination of inflation and unemployment, which was, of course, for that moment, very distressing. And then, although it pains me as a Democrat to say this, Ronald Reagan and his administration saved the system for another 20 years. How did they do that? There were a whole sequence of major, let's say, world events that happened over the course of the 80s and 90s, which made an economic policy program, which at the time I was in a position as a member of the congressional staff of opposing very vigorously. I was in my trench throwing Molotov cocktails at the Reagan cabinet in congressional hearings every week. It was great fun, by the way, but one didn't appreciate just how far the system was going to be saved and in some ways transformed by what was going on. There was, first of all, the debt crisis, affected by high interest rates and monetary policy, which brought about the collapse of a rising set of competing consumer countries. There was, a few years later, the fall of the USSR, with the result that an industrial system that was competing with ours collapsed, and cheap commodities came onto the world market, so commodity prices came back down. There was the opening of China at the same time, and the rise of a vast supply of low-cost wage goods. And then there was the recycling of the oil profits, the oil revenues that were going out to Saudi Arabia, notably, into the American economy, and partly through investments, partly through arms sales. And finally, there was the isolation, to some degree, the punishment of countries that tried to defect from the system. Most notably, and we're still seeing the consequences of this today, Iran. Following the Reagan period, how am I doing? I've eaten 10 minutes, that's not bad. And the administration of the senior Bush, which can be considered a continuation, largely, of the Reagan policies. We moved into the Clinton administration, which met what was described at the time as the challenge of building a bridge to the next century in two ways. One was to unleash the power of the financial sector. I mean, I think that power was part of the matrix of American politics in the 1980s, a growing and increasing part as the manufacturing sector yielded to the combination of cost pressure and the rise of China. But by the end of the 1990s, it was the dominant feature of the American scene. The financial sector grew to the point where at the peak it had 40% of all corporate profits. And its role in the world was substantially destabilizing. In 1997, there was a major destabilization in Asia. In 1998, a major one in Russia. There was not one in China. The reason was China maintained its policy integrity, in part because it got advice from someone who was the chief technical advisor for macroeconomic reform in China, and that was me, saying, don't liberalize your capital account. It'll just do you a lot of damage. But in any event, the upshot here was that this helped to finance on very favorable terms a massive boom of investment in new technologies and information technologies, which brought us to full employment for a three-year period before the turn of the millennium on a surge of business activity. And a lot of that, of course, was here in town. We saw it. It was some of it quite fanciful. It was the age of video games. But it nevertheless was perhaps the last moment when we would see a business-driven, credit-driven expansion of high profitability and high employment. But ultimately, this bridge proved a bridge too far, and maybe not exactly a bridge to nowhere. I don't want to go that there, but one which did not give us a smooth transition to the 21st century. It ended in the bust of the NASDAQ a decade ago, 11 years ago. And the final response in the Clinton administration was almost the complete deregulation of the financial sector, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, and ultimately, at the end of his term, the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which gave us the marvelous innovation of credit default swaps, creating a condition where this one sector, which had risen to real power, had became essentially dominant and beyond challenge and beyond regulation. Under President George W. Bush, I think we learned a number of lessons that were the consequence of a very difficult situation that President Bush faced when he took office. The first is that one could attempt to maintain the American position with military through the exercise of military power, but in the modern world, it proved to be an extremely difficult and extremely limited thing to do. And that's what we have learned as the result of very rough experience attempting to sustain the early successes in Iraq and for the early success in Afghanistan, both of which, to say, very easy to get in, very difficult and very costly to maintain and to prevail. Secondly, I think we also learned that while the U.S. position in the world may be a castle built on air, that is to say something which does not have a foundation either in very strong manufacturing position or a very robust information technology economy or overwhelming, overawing military power, nevertheless, the world does not choose to disturb it very much. And we are still very fortunate that the world itself considers that this arrangement is not an extremely bad one for the rest of the world. People know things could be worse. They know that chaos would be a much worse environment than to have a single major power that is entrusted with making much of the international economic policy environment, with stabilizing the world monetary framework, and having that power be us is something a very large part of the world actually accepts, so long as we do not abuse that power too much. And thirdly, we learned that we could have, if you like, the semblance of ongoing economic growth, but the conditions under which it was achieved were, let's put it this way, deeply questionable. I would even go further and to say the single major force that prevented the economy from appearing to experience a deep stagnation in the Bush years was the mechanisms that drove housing finance, construction, and the lending against home equity. And those mechanisms, which were made possible by the deregulation and desupervision of the financial sector, involved a very large amount of fraud, a very large amount of very discreditable behavior. Okay. What did we learn in the crisis, 2007, 2008, 2009? Sure. What did we learn in the crisis in 2007, 2008, 2009? I think we learned basically three things. The first is that when it is recognized that the system is infected with pervasive and systemic malfeasance with fraud, when fraud is exposed, then the private financial system, construction, home loans, banking services, collapses. It collapses because people lose the basic element of trust that they previously had in their counterparties, and they retreat to safety to try and protect them from abrupt and catastrophic potential losses. And so it is very difficult to recover. And this is something which the models of my professional colleagues, the economists, failed to say. The economists, the business economists, always predict that things will get better in 6 months. We're going to be back on a 3 or 4% growth track. That's just an app. And why? Because their experience in the statistical record is that that's the reasonable thing to predict. In the post-war period, that's largely what happened. But when something happens to the integrity of the underlying system for financing that growth, it doesn't happen. When something happens to the assets against which loans have to be made, the value of people's houses, when you have catastrophic decline in that, then you are basically in the situation faced in 1930, about which Keynes wrote at that time. And it is very much more difficult for the system to recover. But economists, who by and large are statisticians and do not have an institutional view, did not capture or grasp this point. Secondly, we learned that in spite of that fundamental problem, there are major balance wheels in our economy which worked very much to our advantage and helped us stabilize things. One of them is the reduced flow of taxes to the government, simply because we have a progressive tax system and taxes fall more rapidly than income does. Another one is the fact that there are what we call automatic stabilizers on the spending side. People get unemployment insurance, they get Social Security disability, they get all kinds of, compensation for the loss of private income. So although output and employment fell by about 10%, incomes only fell by a couple of percentage points, and things were not as bad as they had been in 1930. For that reason. And thirdly, the central bank operated massively to replace the private credit markets. It basically took over the commercial paper market, stabilized the money market funds. It prevented all kinds of very bad things from happening, both domestically and internationally. Something which I can't fault them for, but one shouldn't expect too much from it. It is not the same thing as being able by itself to give you the motivating mechanisms for a full economic recovery. And thirdly, I think we learned that when you have major banking institutions, the largest banks in the country, which are very close to the boundary of insolvency, if not over it, the failure to take control of that situation and to resolve it creates an institutional and a political problem. An institutional problem because the banks themselves are using resources which are not being turned into commercial industrial loans supporting small businesses, and political because the bankers are symbols of abuse who manage nevertheless to continue to be very highly paid, and it's not surprising that you see Occupy Wall Street as a reaction to that phenomenon. It's also a political problem, and I say this again, it pains me as a Democrat to say this, because those institutions become the place where people leaving government are going to go. And that creates a policy problem. The director of the Office of Management and Budget in the Obama administration became senior vice president for international affairs at Citigroup. That career path does not exist toward any other sector on the same scale. That's a problem for the design of policy. So today, what do we have? It seems to me we have a contest between two ideal types, two characters that the Adam Smith of Glasgow and Edinburgh would have recognized. One of them is the pure emblem of private capitalism, of finance capitalism, Governor Romney, who is running for president on the foundation of his experience in private equity, and whose essential message to the country is that finance capitalism is the way that the country should be run. It's a very particular form of capitalism. It's not manufacturing capitalism. It's very different from the energy-based and hardware-based capitalism of even the most recent Republican administration, from the Bush-Cheney administration. It's not rooted in the oil sector. Right? It's a different animal. But nevertheless, that's where one line of our politics is coming from. And the other one, which I'm going to dwell on a little bit more because, again, it's painful, is what? We have a president who's a combination of lawyer and egghead. A master of the thinking of the think tanks. That is to say, of a certain intellectual structure which has become kind of the institutions of Washington-based thought. And who, if you read the State of the Union message carefully, is trying to cast himself from this very unlikely starting point as the champion of a so-called productive economy, of the manufacturing sector, of an image that we have of ourselves from the days when oil was cheap, when the Sony was a transistor radio that you could get for a few dollars. There are a few people, I think, you must remember that, sir. And when China was waving the little red book at us. For some purposes, I think Adam Smith would describe President Obama as a mercantilist, someone whose basic view is that we should increase our exports, reduce our imports, improve our trade balance, a view which is deeply rooted in the political psychology of the Middle Ages. Though I think actually it's not sincerely held as a belief. But it's clear that the president, and I suspect that Governor Romney as well, are both oblivious at best to the implications of the world in which we actually live, the implications in particular of the role that the market for treasury bonds and bills plays in international finance, and the fact that people like to hold those assets in dollars is a very good thing for us. It means things come in for very basically that we don't have to pay for, and that we are central to the functioning of the world economy, which means people don't want to mess with us as much as they might otherwise. And oblivious also to the fact that the important things in our economic life are not manufactured products, on which we spend an increasingly small amount of our income, but the services that we provide to each other, right? The healthcare and the education and the personal services and, you know, all of those gyms that are all over town where people try and prolong their lives by staying fit. I mean, these are the things which are actually providing the warp and woof, principal warp and woof of our lives, and to put them down as somehow less important, less fundamental than, let's say, making things which can be made for us much more easily by 20-year-olds from the hinterland of rural China, is, I think, let's call it an atavism, an anachronism, a way of thinking which, while deeply rooted in our psychology, thanks to the old Adam Smith, in part, is not really suited to the world in which we actually live. And furthermore, because the president is a lawyer, it is not surprising that the method that's being applied here is tax breaks, which are certainly a little bit standoffish. They don't involve a bureaucrat picking winners, which is no doubt why that method is chosen, but it provides equal opportunity distortion for everybody. So I have to say, as I said, as I promised, I'm an equal opportunity detractor. I do not find either of these approaches to be in line with the world in which we live and the kinds of policies that we need. What would I like to see? I would like to see us recognize that we have very clear, specific kinds of problems that we should be addressing. We do have a foreclosure crisis. Let's deal with that. We have, obviously, an employment crisis. This is a complicated problem because we are never going to replace the massive 15 or 16 million jobs that we've lost. We are never, in people's working lifetime, going to get back to having 66% of the population employed. Those numbers have come down. They're not going back up. We all know that. Technology assures us that firms will economize on labor and continue to do so. So we ought to think about how to make life easier for everybody who's caught in this transition. That's why I favor not raising the retirement age, but lowering it, make it easier for people to leave the labor force and open up the jobs for young people who would very much like to have them. It's not as though you're changing much that way, except removing a source of frustration and futility in people's lives and matching the jobs that are there to the people who need them most while making the lives of people who would like to get out, who've been standing up behind checkout counters or stocking inventory for 30 years easier than they would otherwise be. It's why I also think, and I'll say this briefly, this may run against the grain of some of you here, I've advocated in an article in Foreign Policy for a higher minimum wage, taking my cue from a similar advocacy in a magazine called The American Conservative. Very good magazine, by the way, making the argument that, yes, that would cost some low-wage jobs. Some of those are jobs that are currently attracting undocumented migrants, and we would just as soon discourage that. Some of those jobs are going to teenagers, and it would be better off having them do something else while their families make more money. Okay? So it seems to me this is not a labor capital issue, but an issue of social design, the kind of society that we ought to have, and how to take advantage of simple tools that we currently have and have sometimes used to change things, to make the predicament that we're in more easily managed and to address the problems that we actually face. And as I say, it's a nonpartisan position. My position has no foundation in either the Democratic or the Republican Party, so I feel I can present it to you from a completely dispassionate and neutral perspective. Thanks very much.